listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats. Today, we are going down memory lane to talk about tales from web dev past. So we're going to talk about all of the hot tech in web development that we had to use, and that is like totally obsoleted or killed off or not as popular anymore. Because Scott and I have been developers for what, like 15 years? Something like that?
Very long time. Probably longer than that at this point.
Actually, I have westboss.com/about. I have been making websites for 20 years.
Yeah.
And then I have the number of milliseconds I've been making websites for, and it's accounting.
Have you been mating websites as well? Is that a thing?
Not been mating websites. No, that's no, I have not. When I asked on Twitter, like, what were the things from long time? I'm like, what were the things from like 10, 15 years ago? And then I realized that some of this stuff is way older than 10 years old. 10 years ago was 2010. Yeah. I feel like that was just yesterday. Anyways, we are sponsored by Sanity, which is a structured content CMS, and Sentry, which does all of your error and exception tracking in your application. We'll talk about them partway through the episode. How you doing today, Scott?
I'm doing good. Just, you know, just hanging out, doing the same thing as normal, going a little bit crazy. I have a code release today. I'm pushing a new version of Level Up, so that's inherently stressful. I have a series release today, so that's also stressful. And we're recording a couple episodes of Syntax. So I got a full plate. I got a big old heaping plate. Wes Boss just did some barbecue. He said, how much you want? I said, give it all. Give me it all. Give me everything you got here. So I got a big old plate of barbecue chicken here. But yeah, no, all around, I'm feeling pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm finally back from college, which we were up there for pretty much 6 months. Came back once or twice to pick some stuff up, but we're back in downtown Hamilton, which is the exact opposite of being in a woods, and very happy to have amenities again. There was not a lot of stores up there, and I hadn't had like sushi or kimchi or anything delicious in 6 months, which is funny.
Yeah, that is funny. Like, some of our favorite places are starting to, the ones that have like really died down are starting to come back to the point where you can go get curbside or whatever. So, you know, just the other day, Voodoo Donuts finally, we got like a Voodoo Donuts, like walking distance from our house. And it was, you know, only open for like a month before COVID hit. And then they closed it down just because they didn't need the operating costs. And they just opened it. And it was like the first day it was open. We were like, all right. I know they're overhyped and whatever, but they are very delicious. So we've been gorging out on some Voodoo Donuts now that they're open again.
A bunch of restaurants around here are starting up what are called ghost kitchens. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
So like, instead of just like being like a bar or like a pretty popular sit down restaurant that like never did takeout, and their takeout was kind of hurting because it's not really that, but a lot of them just opened up like secondary businesses that were only on Uber Eats and Skip the Dishes and all these like delivery apps. But they would just like create an entirely new like pizza place or fried chicken place. And like, it would still be made in the kitchen of the restaurant, but they would just focus on like doing one thing and being like kind of this specialty fried chicken place. And apparently it's doing pretty well for them. Hopefully to keep them afloat until they can open up again.
Oh, totally. Right. That's the goal. Everybody's got to find some way to make it happen. And hopefully,
that was kind of interesting. I think we'll see a lot more of that where there's these like, there's no storefronts to these businesses that you order from on Uber Eats. It's just it's some commercial kitchen somewhere that's has nice branding.
Yeah. Yeah. Walk over, pop it in. All right. Let's get into this episode here where we're talking about tales from web dev past. Now, the first and maybe one of the most biggest things that was involved in code we wrote every single day, all day, every day, was doing first layouts and tables and then layouts with floats. And table layouts were older than float-based layouts. Remember when you used to throw everything in a table? That was the whole thing. Tables upon tables upon tables. If you look at HTML email today, that's sort of what all the layouts were like.
Yeah, just lots of nested tables inside of each other. And it's extremely frustrating if you were to ever forget a closing.
Miss a call span.
Table markup themselves is already confusing by itself. And nesting them 6 or 7 levels deep is a world of hurt.
It's a world of hurt. If you've ever done HTML emails, you probably know what that pain feels like. It's not great. But then came along float-based layouts. And float-based layouts were primarily using something like the float property. So I don't know if it was exclusively intended for just floating images. Was that, do you know if that was the exclusive intention of floats in general, was to float an image to either side and let text wrap around it?
Not just images, but like it was meant to take inline block elements and have text wrap around it. So whether that's a div with like a little did you know tip or something like that off to the right or to the left, or whether that's most likely an image where you have text sort of wrap around it. That was the original use case for it.
Yeah. So that was really the whole thing. And all of a sudden somebody said, hey, you know what? If we just take a div and we put a float on it, well, then you can accomplish this kind of layout where you have the modern 2-column layout where you had a sidebar that was, I don't know, like 27% of the total width or 33% of the total width, whatever the golden ratio somebody wanted to make up to say that would work out perfectly. You'd have the sidebar of a specific, there's definitely stuff like maybe your blog archive in the sidebar. And that's still a very common layout today. Don't get me wrong. But The way to accomplish it or anything was with floats. I mean, just think about how crazy it is that we used to do like your header, the logo float to the left, the navigation float to the right, you know, those kind of things inside of a container. And then because of this, you had to implement, which is one of the next things on our list, which is ClearFix. Did you want to talk about what ClearFix is and why we needed it?
Yeah, just because when you have a container and all of the elements inside that container are floated, the container doesn't know about its height because there are no actual non-floated elements inside of it. And because of that, that entire container would just collapse. So if you've got like a wrapper and you've got a sidebar and you got your content and those two things are 20%, 80%, both floated left so that they go snug up right beside each other, let alone, this is actually not even on our list, but remember when we had to add up percentages and then you also could, you would have to use margin and padding and you have to add that up to the entire width of it. So it would add up perfectly. That was before box sizing border box. So we would have these two things, but if you would float them both left, the wrapper would collapse on itself. And then the content that came after the wrapper, like the footer, would just go like underneath all of your content. So what you had to do is to put like an element that was not floated at the very end of it. And it was commonly done by just saying .clearfix. You would add a class of clearfix onto your elements. And what that would do is it would usually use a CSS pseudo after element. And that would just add a block element at the end. And it would make sure it snaps down to its rightful height.
Yeah. And there was also, people found out, well, they didn't find out, its intended use was that you could use overflow hidden on a container to clear the fixes as well. There was a whole lot of several different clear fix until like the clear fix, which was what you're talking about, the just class of clear fix. That was like the eventual, like the de facto way of doing it. But for a long time, a decent portion of your web development time within CSS was figuring out where the flow issues were with your floats, what was flowing out of document, what was actually a part of the document. I remember that being a very difficult concept to teach. I would have to do a lot of background div coloring. This was killed by Flexbox first and foremost, and then later on double killed by the addition of CSS Grid, giving us tools that are actually meant to build complex layouts and make it way, way better and easier than floats. And we don't have to deal with things like a clear fix to clear the floats. All right. Next one is going to be loading screens. Hey, you remember loading screens? I know we used to have a loading screen specifically on our Flash website when I did a band, and it was like, you know, it had a percentage and everything. It had a progress bar and all that stuff.
Click to enter.
Click to enter, yes.
What was really popular was having like buttons. You could like enter the Flash site or enter the the like low bandwidth site or the HTML site. Like you would purposely have two websites depending on your user, if they were on like a, or like a dial up site, I think they called it at some point, because it was like you couldn't handle it to download. Yeah, something like that. Click to enter. So funny. And then someone figured out that you could just enter.
Right. And well, that was
like, they didn't have to click to enter.
They were called splash screens, which are very common in mobile app development now. While things are loading, it's just like a loading screen or whatever, and you still see them on top. But there was like a, for people who don't know, there was a literal trend for a while where it was just like a solid full screen page, and it'd be like, welcome to Scott's site, click to enter. And you had to click, and then it took you to the index page, which is really kind of ridiculous. I don't know why it really came about in the first, like, I don't know if it was like video games or what the influence there was, but I remember for a little while, splash screens were the thing. You had to have a splash screen until somebody said, wait a second, why are we making our users click? I think there was maybe some data that came out around like people leaving your site when they get to a splash screen or something.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember record labels and bands would have like 7 or 8 click to enters.
Yeah.
They would like want to like slam you with all this like new stuff that came out.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. I never see a click to enter anymore, except for beer and cannabis websites in Canada.
Yes. Yes. Are you 19? Are you 18?
Yeah.
Yes. Of course I am, obviously. Hit counters. This was a big one. And you largely saw these in, let's just say sometimes they were on fire or sometimes they look like an odometer, but they would let you know just how many people had been to this web page. That way, if you stumbled upon somebody's page in a web ring and it had been like visited by like 20 people, you were like, well, I don't know about this site. I don't know if this information is any good or not. But then if you hit some that had thousands, you'd be like, all right, this one's popping, right? Like Maddox.xmission or one of those would be popping.
Oh, Maddox. Forgot about that. I actually coded a hit counter. And I did it with serverless functions. And what's the Amazon database?
Dynamo.
Why do I always say it wrong?
Dynamo.
Yeah. And I coded one up. You can go to github.com/westboss/hit-counter. And you can see the oldest part of the web, which is hit counters, and the newest part of the web, which is serverless functions, come together.
Collision course.
Yes. We also, along the same line, we had guest books.
Yeah.
Guest books were really fun.
Guest books were like, super fun.
I think we should add that back. That was really fun. We don't have to describe what they were.
With guest books, I think people might be a little bit more malicious now than they were in the past. Like in the past, I don't remember getting that much. I mean, there was maybe some spam, but I don't remember getting that much like spam or things you had to moderate.
No.
Today, if you put up a guest book, it would be filled with people, you know, posting racist things or, you know, being jerks to everybody else. Nowadays, it would not work that. But I remember our band had a guest book on our band's website, and that was like the message board for our high school. People was like actually like they were using our guest book to chat to each other and sort of like a pre-chat. I mean, ICQ existed at that time, but like it was so funny that like people would actually utilize that to, you know, communicate.
So true. Next up, we have just in general, is just flash websites were super popular back in the day. I never really coded a bunch of flash websites myself. I changed a few here or there, and I definitely had it. And I was more of a iframes guy. Were you into Flash?
Yeah, I was into Flash. I did a lot of Flash. Our band's website, because, I mean, we didn't just have our stuff on MySpace. And to do audio on the web at that given point in time, it was like Flash or bust. So, like, you had to do Flash audio. So we were like, oh, man, it would be cool if the song started playing right when you loaded the site.
Yeah,
the text
that's what
flew
I had.
In
Flash
and
players.
Oh, well, we did it more like the entire site was built in Flash where we wanted to do animations. We wanted to do some interesting things. I had like a video game like select screen where you could like pick the band member to click to go to their page. And it was really cool. We did a lot of Flash stuff like that. And I did Flash all the way up until 2011 when I even applied for a Flash job in Tokyo that I luckily did not get. But my portfolio was all done in Flash. I had done quite a bit of full Flash site work. And this was largely killed off by a couple of things. Flash sites were the way to give you these really dynamic, interesting experiences that you couldn't get on the web even for a long time after Flash sites died. But at some point, Steve Jobs said, hey, Flash, you know, it opens up some security holes. It's maybe not necessarily the best experience at all time. And you know what? We don't want those on our Apple phone. So Steve Jobs laid down the ban hammer on Flash on the Apple phone. And ooh, that basically killed Flash, which is unfortunate in some ways. I don't want to be too fond about Flash because it certainly was a nightmare in some regards, especially performance and security issues. Flash definitely had its pitfalls, but I will say that I owned Android phones for many years that ran Flash video players, no problem. And it was always a blessing, especially when you're trying to watch maybe live sports or something like that. You're trying to watch something in a Flash player. And it always was nice when there was a video player on your phone in the browser. You clicked it and it just worked. And I always hated that about the iPod or the iPhone at the time. This Flash video player doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, what's the better option? And maybe nothing right now. But
yeah,
eventually HTML5 video came along and made that work. I remember even like YouTube was in Flash for a long time. You know, the video player itself, not YouTube itself, but the YouTube video player was in Flash and it worked fine on my Android phone. I could go to YouTube's website and watch a video. And I remember that being a big reason why I chose Android initially over iOS is that and copy and paste. Those are the two things I didn't have that Android had that I really wanted. But for the most part, Flash is gone and I don't really miss it at all. So now that we have HTML5 video and better ways of doing all this stuff, Flash.
It took a long time. We got like HTML5 audio and video, and it probably took like a good 3 years or 4 years for it to like totally be replaced. I remember like tons of websites were just dragging their feet on replacing their players with whatever, and it just wouldn't work. Or like, oh, it was really popular at the time. It's like restaurant menus were all in Flash, and you couldn't look it up on your phone.
You couldn't,
which was really no, I couldn't. I had an Android phone way back then, but like maybe we should just say like Flash was never maybe for I don't know, people who don't know this. Flash was never part of the web. It was always just like a third party app that ran on your computer. It was just embedded into a website. So every time that you ran Flash, it was actually running an app on your computer. And that's why it had to be like installed on your computer every single time. And half the time it didn't work. Silverlight was the same thing.
I was going to say, you remember Silverlight? Oh man, that was some
Netflix
misguided
Silverlight
tech.
Forever.
It was like, you know, this thing that Apple's trying to kill off. Let's just make another one of them. And that like everyone's going to roll their eyes every time they see you must use Silverlight.
I just remember sitting down like every Friday night for dinner and trying to watch Netflix with my wife. And then it would be like Silverlight needs to be updated. And we're like, damn it.
And it was
like
always
not
Netflix.
Even let you play it.
That was the only one that used it. It's actually amazing that Netflix survived after their usage of Silverlight.
it's because we didn't have DRM in HTML5 video.
Yes, absolutely.
And then finally they added it, which was most people didn't want that, but you kind of have to have it. Otherwise, people aren't going to use it.
Especially for media. Anybody who's worked in any sort of licensing or media space knows that that stuff is expensive. I mean, wow. Licensing media or in of any regards, especially once you get into actual major motion pictures, is banana. So yes, they are going to protect it with DRM, even if you believe the web should be open and free, which, you know, yes, you do see a component. But like, yes, the movie producers are not going to sign on to any web technology that does not allow them to protect their property.
No kidding.
OK, so the next one is going to be how we did fonts pre everything. So you youngsters have it easy nowadays. You get your font face. And at the very least, your biggest trouble is trying to figure out if the local, which font, if the actual app font face is loaded or if the local font loaded or what. And now we have dev tools that even solve that for us. For a long time, that was the biggest, or I mean, nowadays, that's the biggest pain. Before, we jumped through a lot of hoops to do some fonts. Now, I did not use two of these. I don't know if you did, so I'll let you speak on those. But I used primarily, this is going to sound crazy to some people, I just used PNGs. Anytime I wanted a custom font, I used a PNG with an alt tag. Hey, PNG, throw some box shadow on there. Then now you get access to all the fonts you've never had. It's like you open up Photoshop, you design the thing in PNG, you export it with a little bit of transparency, just slap it on there as an image. And I actually cringe when I think about how hefty those sites were. I didn't even think about it just because it was like, oh, I want this font. Load it up as an image. Ping. Blow. There it is.
Yeah, I did that a lot. And I don't ever remember once hearing people cry about accessibility. Never. And now if you tweet.
People are just ignorant.
If you tweet a sentence of text as a screenshot, you 400 people saying it's not accessible. So accessibility is one thing that has come a long way
in that.
Yeah. But the ones that I used was QFON and Cipher. And what these would be is they were actually Flash replacements. Was it Flash replacements? One of them was Flash, and I think one of them...
I thought QFON was Flash, but I'm not positive because I didn't use any of them.
Yeah, it's. I'm just looking. They have a stats of it hit its peak partway through 2011 was when it was pretty popular. Basically, what it was is that you would take your font face, and it would convert that to, I believe it was to a Flash file, and then it would go through all of your page and anywhere that you used an image or anywhere that you use like an H1 or H2 or whatever it is that you were selecting, it would go out and replace those with the Flash version of that. And it actually worked really, really well. And that was huge because you were not able to use anything past WebSafe fonts for years, for the entire web before
forever
that.
And then
all of a sudden you're like, how is somebody just using this font that's custom and it's not an image? It was so cool.
So WebSafe fonts, let's see. I have them pulled up here. Can you list 8 WebSafe fonts?
Verdana, Arial.
2. Okay.
Courier.
3.
I don't know. That's the only 3 I know. Verdana, yeah, Arial, and Courier.
And so it's funny because my go-to was always Georgia. So Georgia was I really leaned hard on Georgia. Arial, obviously, you couldn't even use Helvetica, really. Helvetica was only in the fallback because only Mac users had it. I don't even know if there are. Yeah, there's probably only, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's less than 20 WebSafe fonts. So you were really pretty limited at that time in choosing your fonts. It was like, okay, which of these 3 sans serif fonts are you going to go with? I guess I'll go with this one. I don't know. It's so funny. When I worked at the University of Michigan, they actually had Georgia in part of their official branding in the hospital. So I was like, yes, I can use a font that's actually real to their branding.
Was Comic Sans, I think Comic Sans was not web safe, but it was installed on every Windows computer.
W3 schools, Comic Sans was one of the WebSafe fonts.
Oh, that was a good old times.
Good web old safe
time. Fonts. There was also WebSafe colors at some point.
Yeah. I don't remember when that was, but I don't remember having to deal with that too much.
One thing that somebody I asked on Twitter, like, what were the things? And one of the things that were super hot 10, 15 years ago were custom CMSs. You know, everybody made their own PHP, MySQL CMS back
in
the day.
Oh, yeah.
That is not much of a thing anymore. Obviously, people still can make a custom CMS, but this is me transitioning to an ad. One of the popular CMSs that you can use is called Sanity at sanity.io. Sanity.io is a structured content CMS. It's really cool because you can NPM install the CMS. You can go ahead and use it. You can create your own backend. They give you this thing called Sanity Studio, which is the actual CMS itself, and it communicates with Sanity via their APIs. But if you want to create your own custom React components for the CMS, you can still use Sanity, but you can create your own custom React components and even still host it on Sanity Studio, which is pretty nifty. So you have control over the backend of your CMS, control over your front end, but you're still using this awesome service that comes along with everything you'd know and expect from a CMS. So if you want to check it out for your next project, go to sanity.io/syntax. That's going to get you double the free usage tier that gives you more assets, more API requests, more bandwidth. It's pretty sick. Check it out, sanity.io.
Pretty sick. Cool. So let's get into the next one, which is, this is kind of a joke because this wasn't an official topic. Like, this wasn't an official thing, but what I called it was folder-based version control, where your folders would be like old. What was the public? February 2010, you know,
public final 10.
One of my go-to techniques, which I'm sure you've done before as well, is like on your FTP, you're about to upload a new version of the public folder. What do you do before you do that? Well, you duplicate the old one and then overwrite the one that was there. So you duplicate it, you rename it, and then you overwrite the one that was there. And that's how you deploy to a website, ladies and gentlemen.
That was like the original seamless cutover. Yes. Was the rename of the folder. All you had to do is just rename the folder and everything would work.
That is something that we did, you know, in professional work. That's just not hobby work. That's what people did. I mean, sure enough, the big guns still had, was SVN a thing? SVN?
SVN. That's the one that WordPress uses, that one. Subversion, it's called.
Yeah. And Git really wasn't a thing. And when Git came out, real software people were like, finally, this thing exists in a way for the web that people are going to use it. And those of us who were normal web developers and webmasters were all like, I don't understand this. Like, I don't get why. Like, do you remember Chris Coyer had that whole series? It's like me learning Git. And that was like the way I first learned Git, where he was just like, I don't know Git, so I'm going to just like have some videos or lessons that it's like me struggling to learn Git or whatever. And that was like blew it open to me. It's like, oh yeah, the people who are actually using this stuff are pros, you know, the people who you'd consider pros were having to learn it at the same time. But this was killed. The folder-based version control was killed by actual version control and Git and GitHub and all those wonderful things that we use today, along with this next one, which was also killed by Git as well as many other things, which would be FTP, which, granted, FTP as a technology is not gone anywhere, but FTP as a means of deploying your websites and the means of the primary way. Was this ever a thing that you did? Because we did this. What was it? Sublime? Even TextMate had this where you'd rig up your code to be connected directly via FTP or SFTP, and then you edit and save a file, and then the text editor would automatically just upload that file to FTP. Therefore, if you broke anything, you'd get white screens, all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
I did like probably a couple of years of that. I can't even believe that I did that. Like, nobody had local development set up, especially for WordPress. They would just log in. Yes. And this is why people could not move off of Coda forever, because they were so dependent on the save and upload process. Imagine how slow that was. You edit a CSS file, you save it, and the uploads, and then you have to go back and refresh. And now we have like hot reloading and you just instantly see it. But that was surprisingly a very popular way to work, where it would just upload it. And if you accidentally deleted some code, then you better hope you have a backup -1 folder. Otherwise you were pooched from working off the live version of it. And then when people, I saw a lot of people move away from it when they moved to Sublime Text.
Yes.
There certainly was plugins for it, but it didn't come out of the box and it wasn't so married to it. And then people said, oh, okay, well, how are other people doing this? Oh, they're working locally. Yeah, it was called Sublime
SFTP.
FTP.
SFTP.
Yeah, that was it.
Yep. No, you're very right. I think local development, I remember when people were like, they would call it like cowboy coding or something. You're editing files live on the server. Why don't you work on this locally? And I remember at the time, it was just even after I had my first dev job, just being like, that seems like it would be so much harder to maintain two versions of the files, maintaining two versions of the same files. Like, that's hilarious to think of now. But I was like, I got to have a local and a production on that. Seems kind of weird. But now it's so ridiculous to think of that was even a thing.
Totally. Next one we have, this is a bit of a throwback, is CSS Zen Garden. The idea of CSS Zen Garden was they would give you a bunch of HTML. It would be the same HTML for everybody. And then you would code the CSS for that specific HTML. And you would have all kinds of different websites. They would look different. They'd have different backgrounds, different fonts. And it was just a perfect showcase for the power of CSS and this whole idea of separation of concerns, where you have valid HTML markup and on one hand, and then you have CSS that lays it out and designs the thing based on however you want it. And unfortunately, what a lot of people would do is they would absolute position everything because the one thing you couldn't do in CSS at the time was reorder content. And you can do that now with Grid and Flexbox. But I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, the coolest thing about CSS Zen Garden for me was being able to see like the amount of things people could do with it. Because before I really got, I actually had a book. I'm trying to think of what its name was, but I got it on like clearance somewhere. And it really like all it was different CSS Zen Gardens explained. Like that was the entire book. It's like, here's all these different really cool CSS Zen Gardens. And here is how they did it, how they were able to accomplish some of this stuff. Because before CSS Zen Garden, really for me, I had done things in a very ugly way. It looked very like very early web, like very early web until CSS Zen Garden to me. CSS Zen Garden is what took my websites away from being early web to being like actually look not good design wise, but like actually look somewhat more interesting than just really, really archaic stuff. CSS Zen Garden was awesome, and it was most likely killed just by CSS getting easier, because like when CSS got easier and you got access to doing more and interesting things, well, all of a sudden completely transforming this HTML doesn't seem like that crazy of a thing anymore, because it didn't require interesting or useful techniques. It required techniques that were just baked into CSS itself. So I think that's probably why it doesn't exist anymore. You still see things that are like similar to it, but not really.
It does still exist, and a lot of stuff is absolutely positioned.
Yeah.
And it's got all those web font classes on the HTML, which was from, what was the Adobe font displayer? What was that called?
Oh,
it's still a thing, obviously.
It's still a thing. That was like an early font replacement. That was the first one.
Typekit.
Typekit.
That was the one. Yeah, that was big, where you could pay for fonts and just like load them.
It didn't used to be owned by Adobe either. When it first came out, it was just its own thing. Yeah. I remember that's when I learned the one pixel highlight trick, where if you had a button and you put like a one pixel line of CSS, like a border top of whatever that background color of, just slightly lighter, then it looked like it gave it this emboss thing. And then maybe you throw a little gradient on there, and then you get these
all
like
about that.
Really embossed buttons. I was all about that too. And Typekit was a really excellent CSS. I remember diving into that CSS and being like, yes, this is my jam.
Next, we have just like text editors in general. So TextMate was the big one at the time. That's like, I think like, at least for me, a lot of people started in Dreamweaver and then they switched over to TextMate. Along with TextMate, there was Coda, which still has a very loyal following. They were working on Coda 2. Notepad++, I think they still have a pretty loyal following, but it's not nearly what it is for something like a Sublime Text and now what is VS Code.
Yeah, and even in a different category, you mentioned Dreamweaver. Back when it was Macromedia Dreamweaver is when I first started using it. And then there was also Adobe had their own called Go Live. And then there was Microsoft Front Page. And those were the three sort of visual editors that were king. And Coda really sort of straddled the line between a true visual editor like Front Page and Dreamweaver, and still gave you a bunch of the text stuff, but like some handholdy stuff for like neat, like instead of having to write CSS hexes, it gave you, you know, the ability to quickly pick a color or something like that. I did go Dreamweaver to TextMate. I skipped over Coda and then went from TextMate to Sublime and then to VS Code. So this was largely killed by editors getting a lot better. And Front Page got killed by Adobe buying Macromedia. Adobe bought Macromedia, or not Front Page, Go Live. Go Live was Adobe's version of essentially Dreamweaver before Dreamweaver. It like tried to simplify a lot of things. Either way, Adobe bought Macromedia and then Dreamweaver became their product. And they kept them both side by side for a little while. And it's really unfortunate that my college curriculum web development course was like, basically, here's how to use Adobe Go Live. That's what the course was. It wasn't about HTML. It wasn't about anything else. It was like, here's how to use Adobe Go Live, which of course became obsolete like 1 year later. So this is definitely something that's been killed off by modern tooling. Now, the next one is going to be sliding doors. Now, I'm going to take a guess on this. Is that where you had a horizontal layout where they were sort of like sideways accordions that opened? Is that sliding doors?
No.
Okay.
No, that was a good guess, but sliding doors was a technique for buttons where if you have, like, imagine a button with round corners on either end and a gradient in the background. You couldn't do border radius, you couldn't do gradients, you couldn't do any sort of custom buttons with CSS. So what you would do is you would take your button design and you would slice it into two pieces. And the left-hand side would be your rounded corners, your gradient, and it would be like 2,000 pixels long. And then you would have a right image that would you would just overlap and then absolute position a couple of pixels over top of it. And the idea is that you could have dynamically sized buttons that had cool backgrounds and borders and all that stuff. Without having to make a custom size button for every single thing. And it would just, the idea is that the left is super long and the right is just the end cap, and the end cap would just overlap the edge of it. So that looks like a dynamically sized button. Just Google sliding doors CSS to visually see it.
We did that all the time. That was definitely a, because I mean, if you wanted fancy buttons, there's no other way to do it. I mean, there was like a lot of techniques there around those types of things. All right. Next one would be the PNG fix. Now, the PNG fix, I don't know technically how it worked, but back in the days of, I believe, IE6, Wes and I kind of chatted about this before, you couldn't use transparency in images. That's like a funny thing is that even in Dreamweaver, so Dreamweaver's internal browser, whatever it may have been, allowed you to do transparency in images. And the browser that I was using at home, whether it was Firefox or whatever at the time, allowed you to see transparency in images. But I was working on some sites and I had people saying, hey, why does this look so weird in my browser? These images look very odd. And I say, oh, I don't know anything about that. It looks fine for me. That was probably the first instance of it looks fine for me in my entire web development career, was finding out that Internet Explorer 6 did not have transparency on images. Because all of a sudden people were like, these images look like crap. And I'd just be like, it does. It looks fine. It looks fine to me. So on Safari, whatever, it looks fine. And it took a little while before I figured it out. So you could not do image transparency. To do transparent images, you needed to have a 1 pixel by 1 pixel transparent GIF. Do you know how this actually worked in practice, Wes?
I just looked it up because I was like, now that I actually understand web development, I bet I could figure it out. So it was a HTC file, which was some sort of like special IE specific proposal that never went through, but IE implemented it anyway.
Classic IE.
Yeah, it looks like it's just a JavaScript file that loops over the image and creates an element and sets it to be the color of the background of the thing that it is on. And I don't really know how that worked, but I guess just by, oh, it was a VML. There's some VML thing in IE would make it transparent and make it show through whatever was behind it. So it looks like it's just 200 lines of JavaScript, which I totally understand now. I could probably sit down and totally get how this works. But at the time, it was just magic, or you just throw this HTC in there and your images would be transparent.
It felt like magic. All I knew was that like the first time I figured it out, it was pretty awesome. So big fan of that technique in the time.
This one is kind of like the sliding doors technique. It's called a 9-panel layout. So if you had a div where you wanted to put a custom border around it, or really anything, like a pretty popular thing on banned websites would be to put a grunge border around the entire, like an entire thing of text. And if you wanted that, you don't necessarily know the width or the height of that thing. You probably knew the width of it because everything was fixed width, but the height of it would be dependent on how much content was written. And the thing that you would do is you would make a 9-panel square. So if you think of a square, the center is most of your content, and then top, right, bottom, left is your corners, and then top, right, bottom, left is the filled out pieces, and then the piece in the middle is where your actual content would go. And you'd have repeating backgrounds on all of those, except for the top, right, bottom, left corners. Those would be your actual border corners. And that was very, very hard to do because you would also combine that with a table and repeating background images. And luckily that thing is not, we just have CSS now. We don't have to worry about any of that.
Yeah, in Android, it was called a 9-patch, like an actual Android development. Because I remember I had to do quite a bit of that to do rounded borders and stuff in Android development when I did some level up tutorials videos on that. Next up is going to be CSS3, please. CSS3, please was this really awesome site that came out at the time when CSS3 was just starting to take off. And this was a Paul Irish joint, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was done by, this is actually freaky. I said the Paul Irish joint, just like, you know, going like a Spike Lee thing. And then I kid you not, I'm on css3please.com and it says copyright 2012, a Paul Irish and Jonathan Neal joint. They use the thing I don't think I've ever said that before. And I just said it. So this thing it was so cool because, man, we had all these vendor prefixes right when CSS3 came out. It was like, you couldn't just do a box shadow. You had to do a hyphen WebKit box shadow, whatever. You had to do all these things. And each time you wanted to do it, you had to have all the prefixes. Well, there's no auto prefixer to just add them for you. There was no real good way of doing this, especially if you weren't using things like SAS at the time. So right at this time, man, Here's what you would do. You would say, I want a box shadow. You would go to css3please.com. You would edit the line of snippet they have for box shadow. Then you'd copy and paste all of the Chrome extensions with comments, letting your other developers know which browsers those things are supporting. And then you'd paste it into your site. Wow. I cannot imagine working like this, but I did. I did it every day. Man, that just seems like so extraneous.
That was the way, so yeah.
Shout out to Paul Irish, Jonathan Neal for that. That was a classic.
It was only 10 years ago that this was a thing.
Yeah. Like,
the modern web as we know it has just been built in 10 years, 12 years. It's pretty incredible to see that was, I guess that is a long time, but there's probably people listening to this podcast who were like 5 years old.
Right. This is definitely a get off my lawn episode.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So Scott and I are just looking at the list here, and there's probably 20 more things that we have. So we're going to pause it here and pick it up on the next show. And we've got a whole bunch of interesting things from times past as to how we used to do things. And hopefully you're finding, even if you weren't a developer back then, you're probably finding this interesting about how we did it in the olden days.
I think it also provides some context too. You know, some context to where these solutions are and why people are so happy to have the solutions we have nowadays. It lets people know that, hey, we couldn't be building these really complex things because you just, even just simply getting a border radius on something was a complex endeavor. So
so true. Was very tough. You know what also was tough, Scott?
Trying to find out where your errors and bugs are happening and came from. So Our sponsor this week is Sentry. It's great. Wes is wearing a Sentry t-shirt today. I'm so hyped about that because it's a really nice shirt. So Sentry at sentry.io is the place to track all of your errors and exceptions. And let me tell you, Sentry has a lot of these really great features from being able to tag each of your releases. So let's say, hey, I fixed this bug. I can say, you know what? I know I fixed this bug. I'm really good at coding. I typed the right words. The words fixed the bug. And then I deployed it. And then you can click, yes, I fixed that. And then all of a sudden, you get an email from Sentry saying, hey, this bug that you marked as being fixed in version 10.5, well, it's still there in 10.6. So you need to get back to work, son. So that is what Sentry does for me. And I absolutely love it. Sentry is like a pal that has always got your back, letting you know whenever you made some mistakes in your code and you weren't there to see it. It's fantastic. So head over to sentry.io, use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, to get 2 months for free. It's a tool that you are going to want to use because I want to use it and I've been using it for years and I still want to use it. So that's the sign of a good tool. So thank you so much to Sentry for sponsoring.
Awesome. Let's get into some sick picks. I got a good sick pick for you today.
Sorry, what?
This summer, I became a small engines mechanic.
I've noticed.
I worked on all kinds of really fun stuff. I got an old Sea-Doo that I've been fixing up, and I think I worked on like 4 or 5. And one thing that I noticed is that there is a lot of Allen bolts on these things.
Huh.
And the frustrating thing about Allen keys is that they are very slow to turn, right? And also, usually people don't have both metric and imperial Allen keys. So they use the closest one and then they end up stripping out the inside of the Allen key because a lot of Allen key stuff is like aluminum. So I did that myself. And I was finally like, I have all the proper Allen keys, but it's really slow. So I finally got Allen key bits for my drill and Ooh. Impact driver. And you can certainly destroy furniture with these, because you shouldn't, like if you put together IKEA furniture and you have these, you can certainly wreck it. But if you know what you're doing and you're careful, having all the sizes of proper Allen keys for your drill is key. And I was just like, why did I not have this before? It was like $15 for a set of every single one ever. And now I can move much quicker. So I've been on like a serious tool kick for the last couple of years of just finding like the proper tools for doing the job. And this is definitely one of them that I wish I had got it earlier. So I'll put a link to the one I got specifically. And I think that it doesn't matter all that much. They say they're super hard, but the thing, I got them on Amazon. The thing you have to worry about sometimes with Amazon tools is that they're very soft metal and they'll just wreck easily.
Yeah, cheap.
But for the case of this is that you kind of want your bolts and your things to be the same hardness. Otherwise, you're going to strip them out if you go too quick. So with that sort of caveat, be careful. Definitely pick yourself up a set.
Cool. I am going to sick pick something for those of us who have been working from home and maybe you want to step up your lighting game for your just your home studio in general. A lot of people are getting into these types of things where it's like actually being on camera, Twitch streaming or whatever. And one of the things that can really take your setup to be a little bit less amateurish is a good lighting setup. Yeah, sure. You want a better webcam, but a better webcam and crappy light is still not going to look great. So I am going to sick pick these LED lights that I got. It's $130 for a 2-light set, which is really, really reasonable for studio lamps, especially considering these studio lamps will blow your face off. They're so bright if you want them to be. So I love these little lamps. It's just a panel of LEDs. It's very cool. It gives you gels to change the color. You just plug them in. There's big, tall stands. I set them up on the side of my desk. And let me tell you, even on the lowest brightness settings, these things still totally fill my space. I'd imagine if I were to use them elsewhere, that they would be just totally as effective. It's funny, we use these for family pictures and stuff. Let's say we're going to be doing a family portrait in the living room. I'm not just bringing out my camera and my tripod. I'm hustling these lights in here and I'm going to get a nice full lighting setup. So these are really fantastic lights. I am the type of person who had originally bought these giant light boxes in the past. So I've had like several iterations of like lighting setups and nothing has been cheaper, easier, better, faster than LED lights. And these LED lights are definitely at the point where like the technology has gotten there. I think the only place they could go from here is to be cheaper, but these ones have barn doors. They're really nice. They don't get hot. You might not have been in this world, but I used to have to do lighting setups and it'd be for different rock musicians, right? X, Y, and Z guitarist would come into the studio. I would have to do the entire setup. I used to work for this magazine, Guitar World. So let's say Trey Anastasio, the guitarist of Phish, he comes in, right? He's a big rock star. He's sitting down. And then like, while I'm setting up the audio, I'm setting up the backdrop, I'm setting up the camera, I also have to set up the lighting. And you have these like super powerful lamps that have these things called barn doors, these big metal barn doors, which all of the lights should have. And the barn doors would get so hot, it would burn your entire finger off if you were to touch it. So you had to use like a burn handle and like whack it to kind of get in the right spot. Just like tap it a little bit. So that used to be a thing of the past. Now these things stay super cool. So big fan of these lights. Check it out if you are into needing any sort of lighting setup. These have been my go-tos of choice. Shameless plugs, Wes. You got anything to plug?
I'm going to shamelessly plug my upcoming course. It probably won't be out by the time you listen to this, but might be mastergatsby.com. It's going to be my course on mastering Gatsby. We use Sanity as a CMS on the back end. Lots of CSS little tricks that they're going to learn along the way. Custom React Hook is going to be a good one. So get ready for that.
Cool. I am going to plug my latest two courses. I just did a course on React 3D using React 3 Fiber in JavaScript. Talk all about things like the new Stripe website, maybe Transmit's website, things like that are utilizing 3D on the web. This is something that you're going to see happening more and more often. So you want to check out my course on leveluptutorials.com/pro. And also out this month is animating React with Framer Motion 2. It's the follow-up to the critically acclaimed previous animation course with Framer Motion. So it's very cool. We do all sorts of practical examples. It is nonstop practicality in that course. So check those out at leveluptutorials.com.
Awesome. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we will catch you on Monday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.